Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. Let's face it, home cooking advice from chefs is, well, a lot of time it's not really home cooking advice. Get your mise en place ready. Yeah, sure. But today we have an episode from a while back about real home cooking with chefs, like how to cook a steak that you forgot to defrost. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Look, I'm going to be honest about a little corner of food media. The world does not need another story about how chefs cook at home. The reason is because, you know, most chefs who do cook at home basically cook like they do at their restaurants, and the other ones, you know, they store their sneakers in their ovens and keep nothing but hot sauce and beer in the fridge. But that's not to say that most chefs do not love home cooking. They especially love it when you do it, or someone else does it for them. Later in the show, we'll visit the kitchen of Kenji Lopez-Alt, the author of the New York Times number one bestseller, The Wok, where he'll show us his favorite dish from his childhood. And we're going to start with a duo of Daniel Holtzman and Matt Rothbart. Matt's a longtime food writer and cookbook author, and his friend Daniel is a chef with restaurants in New York and L.A. And together, I don't know, they spend like half their time talking to each other about food, and the rest of their time, apparently, they spend being asked questions about food from their non-professional friends. So they wrote a book. It's called Food IQ, and it tries to answer every question that you would ask them, too. It's got everything from, should you spend $150 on a knife and you can have a $30 one, to the craziest thing you can do in a home broiler. Hey, Matt.
Francis, what is going on?
Hey, it's good to talk with you. And hey, Daniel, how are you?
It's nice to see your face. It's lovely to be able to Zoom. The future's here.
All right, so congratulations on your book. And I have to say, like, you know, I see a lot of cookbooks in my life. And, you know, most of them start from a place of, here's a story I want to tell, or, hey, here's a bunch of great stuff, and this is why you want to make it. But yours is a little bit different than that. So how did this book come to be?
Francis, we decided long ago that we were going to be friends first. Like, that's where a good book starts. And so Daniel and I met 10 years ago. I was writing about the meatball shop, the opening of his restaurant in New York. And mm-hmm. I soon realized that I had a kind of a partnering question. I had a guy who I loved spending time with and just like talking about food all the time. And so we started as writing partners first. And we wrote a column for Savour and we wrote for Taste. And over that period, it became clear that we both had our own kind of lane. Me being the writer, the guy with the tape recorder, the guy who kind of was writing cookbooks and writing, you know, editing a food magazine. And then there's Daniel, the guy with all the questions in his brain and all the answers in his brain. So I felt like it was a symbiotic relationship, right, Daniel? I felt like we were always asking each other questions.
Yeah, I think as a chef, you're constantly getting folks ring you up and ask you questions. And, you know, as a food journalist, you're constantly getting folks ring you up and asking you questions. And some of them are like, you know, how should I cook this piece of salmon? I can't tell you how many times someone said, you know, I got a piece of salmon. How should I cook it? And, you know, after years and years and years of that, you realize a lot of folks have the same questions. And maybe we could create a resource for them to answer some of the most often asked ones to help people feel less intimidated, because the kitchen is intimidating for people and it shouldn't be.
Yeah. So are these questions like ones that like truly are just like, I just get asked this all the time, or like what percentage of the ones are like, let's sneak in a few where I want to say something here. I'm going to frame it in we're going to play Jeopardy. I'm going to like, you know, do it in the form of a question, but really I'm just trying to say something here.
I don't think that we were really standing on our soapbox too often. There were definitely some questions that were exciting for us to research and some projects. I think a few of them were some, you know, there's a chapter about busting some myths. And I think there were a few areas where, you know, there's a lot of snake oil sales folks out there telling you, you know, that if you buy this gadget or if you use this ingredient. And so there are a couple of items that we thought, you know, maybe we should kind of set the record straight. And, you know, I think there were a few in the tools and technology. I think there were a few that were exciting for us to learn about.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, if you're in a position where you're constantly fielding questions, it doesn't mean you're not in a position where you're also not asking questions all the time yourself anyway, right? So do you have favorite questions in the book? Like something that blew your mind when you first learned it and you're dying to let everyone know?
I mean, I feel like we had this question about canned beans that I felt like we needed to hash out because we almost came to blows on Instagram in the comments
Matt
section.
Matt just likes this question because he turned out to be right.
I turned out to be right. I was using canned beans. It was early in the pandemic, and Daniel definitely jumped in, as he tends to do on social media, and was like, yo, what, why? What's up? Like, he was really questioning my use of canned beans. And I felt like in that question, you hear our voice. Like, you really hear us kind of working through this idea that, yes, you can buy great Rancho Gordo beans. Steve Sando, shout out to that guy. Like, amazing stuff. But sometimes you actually don't have the time to soak and then cook the beans. So, yes, using a can of, you know, white beans or chickpeas or red beans in cooking was actually okay. And I think Daniel eventually gave me the cosign that it was okay to cook with canned beans.
I was really shocked by the frozen vegetables. You know, Matt and I started talking about frozen vegetables, and I really was like, I knew what I was talking about. You know, you freeze vegetables and they're just no good. And then, you know, I heard myself being so snarky about it, mm-hmm. And so close-minded that it was like, all right, well, let me prove how right I am. And we were so shocked by how the quality of some of the frozen vegetables out there. We made an asparagus, like a spring asparagus risotto. It was like the thing I could think of that would be the least pleasant. You know, yeah. I was like, how could I be as rude as possible to prove my point? And the asparagus turned out to be like crunchy and vibrant and flavorful. And it was really good. It was really good. It was so good that I was like, it shut me up. And it was so good that I'm talking about it.
Yeah. Right, so, on.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm glad this is an open-minded and free-flowing conversation. This is a real meeting of ideas. So let's actually, since we're talking about ingredients, I want to roll into some of the questions you have in your book. And one of the ones I'm not sure I buy.
And I knew this was going to happen, Francis. I knew this was going to happen.
And I don't actually, I apologize. I'm like always quoting these questions. Some of them are just like paraphrased, but they're as I remember them. But you have one that is basically, why should I ever use canola oil when I can always use olive oil? Speak on this. Why should one use canola oil?
Well, look, man, there are tons and tons of folks out there that, you know, hear like olive oil is better for you. Olive oil is great for you. And you should always use olive oil. As a cook who is most of my food is in restaurants is Mediterranean and, you know, mm-hmm. like Mediterranean centric. Yeah. Olive oil is pretty much the only oil I use. But for anybody that's like, you know, mixed olive oil and soy sauce together and tried to make a salad dressing out of it, you know, the oftentimes you realize like there are certain flavor combinations that clash with olive oil. Mm-hmm. And we're not saying that canola oil is the only thing that you should use instead of olive oil, but it's an example of a light flavored oil, vegetable based oil that has a lot of use. You know, do you use olive oil for everything? No chance.
No. I do love olive oil, and yeah, I don't think I would use it in every situation. Not least because it's really expensive. So you should like keep the good stuff and use it for how it's best featured. But I don't get why people say canola oil is a neutral flavored oil.
Oh, you feel it has a strong flavor.
I totally do, especially really? Since
at high temperature. Of course, it does at high temperature.
Yeah, if you're, you know, emulsifying it, it has. It's generally fine. I'm not going to get into like the nerdiness of like, oh, it's like, you know, slightly more this way, you know, more notes of this than, you know, any other oil. But if you're using to saute, which is what people say you should do with it, because it's a high, you know, it's a high temperature, high smoke point oil. it always smells like metallic fish in my house. Am I the only one?
Interesting. I wonder whether we are cooking, you know, maybe you're doing more of a high temperature, quote unquote, saute. If that's the case, and I didn't know this. This is the first I've ever heard this. So I am excited to both try that out and then hopefully prove you wrong. Come back on and just smash it down.
Wait, Matt, where are you on canola oil and high heat?
I think this gets at the point, like, we wrote Food IQ to really address a home cook who might have only two choices of oil, olive oil mm-hmm. and canola oil. So we have to, and this kind of goes into, like, where I come from. I come from a world of food writing, and I kind of checked ourselves, and I've been a snob in my life, and I kind of assume that everyone has peanut oil and has a lot of oils. But when it comes down to it, a lot of the readers for our book have two types of oil, canola and olive oil. So I think we kind of addressed it from that point of view. And said that basically you can use canola oil for, yes, emulsifications, I agree, are a little bit more desirable than a high temperature. I do get a little bit of that funk that you're talking about. I know what you're saying. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I think this really unpacked a nice question, I think, Francis.
Yeah.
I'm very excited about this conversation, and I'm looking forward to testing it out.
All right, actually, while we're talking about fats, you have another great question. What is brown butter, and why is everyone cooking with it?
Yeah, that was one of the ones that was another shocking one. We were researching that question. You know, you see a lot of brown butter in Italy, and mm-hmm. We were using it as an example of like classic kind of like preparations of where brown butter has been used. And after doing a tiny bit of research, we realized like brown butter didn't find its way to Italy until the 1990s. And it was really fun and strange for us because, you know, there's this like ricotta gnocchi with brown butter and sage that's kind of like ubiquitous. Everywhere you go, you find it. And I was like, what region is that actually, you know, indigenous to? Because, you know, Italy, often the dish, you can trace it back to its kind of region.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was going through some old cookbooks and I couldn't find any reference to it. I'm like, this is really driving me crazy. Like, where did it come from? And we spent some time with the folks. There's like a gastronomy center in Rome that does some, you know, connects back to the past of Italy and tries to keep a track of where the food is coming from. And they were like, no, that didn't get here until French food migrated down in the 90s and it came with them. We're like, oops, okay. Strike that from the text. Yeah. It's very, you know, you write a book and you write something like how neutrally flavored canola oil is, and it, you know, your hens tend to roost. Like, it comes back for
some
you.
Jerk radio interviewer decides to just tell you you're wrong about it.
You know, once it's written in print, it's like it's written down. It's there's something about print that's so
terrifying.
It really keeps you honest.
We're talking to Matt Rodbard and Daniel Holtzman, authors of Food IQ. We'll be back with them with some of your questions in a minute. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. and listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're here with the authors of Food IQ, Daniel Holtzman and Matt Rodbard. We've already debated the merits of canola oil, and now we're talking about something much more delicious. Let's get back to it. Okay, so brown butter and sage, which is, in my mind, one of the classic, you know, Italian sort of sauces, more like a condiment, really. Doesn't have a thousand-year history, but if we're just getting to the ingredient of brown butter, which is, you know, as simple as literally heating butter until it turns slightly brown, mm-hmm. and you get all that, like, really cool, complex flavor out of it, it was like a chef-y thing, it felt like, and has, like, migrated into home kitchens. And to me, it was always about pan sauces like that, but you're right about brown butter in cookies.
Lattes.
Talk about some of the ways you're psyched about using brown butter.
Well, I think there's a psychology there. When you hear brown butter, you're like richness and like umami or nuttiness. And so mm-hmm. a cookie with brown butter, it's like naturally, just as it's written on a menu, it ratchets it up and it has that brown, that umami flavor. And there's a real marketing element here. And we talk about the psychology of some of these choices that we make in the kitchen. It isn't all about the X's and O's of cooking.
Yeah. Any area that you would add butter, any recipe you'd add butter, you can add brown butter and it definitely kicks it up. It's like, for a minute there, when no one knew what you were doing, it was like, ooh, we've got a secret. You know, it's like now I feel that way about MSG now, where I'm like, oh, you suckers don't realize that all I did was add MSG and it made it way better. And like everybody else is like, we shouldn't use that. I'm like, oh yeah, you shouldn't. It's like imagine the first guy that like discovered salt. Brown butter felt a little bit like that. You're like, I got a secret.
Yeah.
The reality is if you make a brown butter snickerdoodle cookie, it is really, really, really delicious. But like most things, once people learn the trick behind the magic, it's less a magic trick, right?
Yeah, it's just something you can do.
Less magic, more trick.
So getting to the trick, like I said before, like making brown butter is as simple as just cooking butter until it, you know, totally melts and then you start to see a little bit of brown. When you're making it, is there a method you use to make sure it doesn't burn, or how do you know when it's brown enough?
The more dark it becomes, the more nutty it becomes. And obviously at a certain point, it goes from, you know, nutty toasted flavor to bitter burnt flavor.
Acrid.
You know, and I think the best way to avoid that is obviously going slow. Slowly is better, because we've all tried to make an omelet in the morning, bleary-eyed, had the pan on too fast and made burnt butter immediately.
Right on. Cool. So just cook it over like a medium low until you start to, you know, it smells good and then you're good.
Yeah. And a very, very light brown butter will have a faint and gentle flavor. Just like most things that are cooked in fat, because you're cooking the butter solids, milk, proteins, and all that stuff in the fat itself. There's a significant carryover cooking because the oil will, or the fat in the butter will maintain its heat. So pull it off early because you can't really cool it down and slow it down.
Right on. Cool. Actually, since we're talking about a hot pan right now, let's talk about how do we get crispy skin on fish?
Ooh. I mean, the cooking of a fish in a pan is one of the great challenges I've always found. And I think we've addressed it in the book with a lot of like honesty, meaning, yes, me, Matt, the writer here, has burned their fish and has peeled it off too early. So like that was a realization. But I mean, really, in speaking with Dan about the way you cook crispy skinned fish, it's really knowing that moment when it releases the skin. It's knowing that that moment will happen and knowing that you can't force that moment. There's a real feel to it.
I do feel like so much of cooking, you know, we talk about, you know, how intimidating the kitchen is. So much of cooking is just the confidence to like wait for it. There's a great Rumi quote about that, like just wait for it. But it's so nerve-wracking when you think that skin is burnt. And then you flip it over and it's like, wow, what a miracle. But, in real life, obviously there are a couple of other tricks, like drying the skin will get you a lot closer. If you're not confident in a nonstick pan, you know, for a chef, a nonstick pan is a bit of like cheating, but they are a fantastic tool that works really well, and you can, it will save you for your first bunch of tries. So I think you first look at how thick your piece of fish is, okay. And then from then you're going to adjust the temperature of your pan. So if you want to crisp the skin on a very thin fish, thin piece of fish, like a, you know, maybe like a piece of red snapper or something that's, you know, half inch thick, you need a hotter pan than, say, if you want to crisp the skin on a piece of salmon, because if you cooked them at the same temperature, the snapper might be overcooked by the time the skin was crispy.
Sure.
So what I mean by that is, you know, the thinner the fish, the hotter the pan. And then I season the fish and then pat it dry with a paper towel right before I put it in the pan, with a little bit more oil than you probably think you're going to need. And that's another good trick is you get your pan nice and hot, you throw your oil in right when it starts to smoke. Mm-hmm. You gently lower the fish in away from yourself. So if you drop it, as we inevitably do, it doesn't splatter all over ourselves. And then I immediately lower the flame. I lower the flame to a medium if it's going to be like a red snapper thin, and maybe even like a medium low for a piece of salmon. Using a spatula, I tend then to hold the fish down and I'll pour some of the oil off. So I start with more oil than I need and then I pour some of it out.
Okay.
And then I generally shake the pan and try to stop it, because if you could stop it from sticking right away, you're great. If it locks in and sticks, then it's just, you're just going to sit there and wait for it until it releases itself.
Do you press on the fish while it's cooking?
The more skinny the fish, the more skin to flesh ratio, like a piece of snapper is a lot more skin to flesh ratio than salmon per se. It tends to curl because the skin, the muscles and skin or whatever, they contract at a different rate. So it tends to like curl up. You get that wet, kind of not crispy section in the middle. So I wait until the fish starts to relax and then I press it down with a spatula to make sure that all the whole piece of fish is contacting. And I'll cook it like 85% of the way on the skin side. I mean, you could start to see the protein almost start to bubble out. You know, it just starts to go like a little bit translucent at the very top. And then I'll flip it over for the last second, because the goal is to really have that skin be shatteringly crispy, right? Like you want to be able to, you want to be able to come back the next morning, crunch on it on the fridge and think, whoa, that's still crispy.
Yeah. And so you, okay, that's cool. So you're mostly cooking the fish on one side. You're not doing that thing we talked about where you're just flipping and flipping and flipping and flipping.
No.
Right on. And I'm going to do one more question from the book before we get to our callers. It's about the broiler. You know, I think a lot of people use it just for, you know, crisping the top of something. But I read in your book this absolutely bonkers idea that you can take a frozen steak, throw it under the broiler, and get a crisp crust and a medium rare in 10 minutes.
Did you try this?
Did I try it? No.
Yeah. Oh, you got to try it.
I had the same response when we talked about this, because when we were writing the book, I'm asking him, to your exact point, we only melt cheese in our broilers. I live in a small New York City apartment. I have a broiler. Let's use it. Let's go. And so Daniel made this claim, and I was like, no. Like, homie, no. Like, that's not good. But I, in testing all these recipes, obviously I did it, and it made me realize, and this is the great thing about Food IQ, is there's like just a new way to look at our common appliances and our gadgets and what we have in our house. And it sometimes takes a chef's ingenuity. And also really good beef. Like, let's get real. Like, it can't be something that's been in the back of the freezer for like 2 or 3 months. So let's like give the meat a little credit here. It's working a little bit. You know, wouldn't you agree, Daniel?
I think that they probably cooked the steak at Denny's this way. that might have been the original inspiration, you know. And it's like a very, very thin, thin steak that, you know, when you want to keep it, how do you get a really thin steak to be medium rare in the middle but crispy on the outside? And it's like, well, if I freeze it, it's going to stay colder on the inside, but it would still brown, like that like Maillard reaction or whatever they call it thing happened. And so on the outside, probably at the same rate, whether it was frozen or not, that's not affected. So like, interesting. But wrestling, I wrestle pretty seriously. And I, you know, would often come home from the gym ravenously hungry. And I've got a proper chef's fridge. So I've got like lots of meat in the freezer and I got 1,000 condiments and I've got nothing else. And I pulled one of those steaks out of the freezer and stuck it under the broiler and it worked. It worked really, really well. It was really shocking. And I kept on
That's
doing
bonkers.
It.
Okay. So, okay. I need some specifics here. So you're talking about like, I don't know, call it like an inch thick ribeye or something.
Yeah, I had you know, Patrick from Heritage Foods. I always have steaks in the freezer. I think they're the best steaks in the world. I like that guy a lot. I had a bunch of his steaks in the freezer, and I just literally put some salt on there, put it on a pan, and put it right under the broiler.
And
I wait until it's, you know, the full whatever it is, 4 or 5 minutes until it's begun to, begins to crisp and brown, and then I flip it and I cook the other side. And that's it. I mean, it really is like, that's it. And that, it
yeah,
works.
I
mean, give it a try.
Right on. I love that. I'm going to try that out for sure. Okay, let's go to some of our listeners' questions. I know Paul really, really, really wants to know your thoughts and feelings on French toast. Let's go to Paul.
Hi, this is Paul from Indianapolis. I'm kind of a breakfast guy. And I personally think that French toast is one of the most underrated breakfast dishes that there are because there's a lot of different combinations. And I just wondered if you had any suggestions on different kinds of bread you could use and different kinds of mixtures of the egg, milk, vanilla, et cetera, kind of ingredients. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Paul.
My first instinct is to go to your computer, log into Bread's Bakery, buy a babka, and do babka French toast. Because Ooh. Babka French toast honestly is like nothing you've had, and it's something that I've done like twice a year forever.
Really?
So that's my first instinct.
Wow.
That's
very decadent.
That sounds incredibly good. Okay, so for folks who don't know, babka is, it's like a rich yeasted dough. But yeah. With usually, it depends on the kind of babka, right? You can have a chocolate babka, you can have cinnamon
or chocolate,
usually
right?
Usually with this like swirl of chocolate paste inside it or cinnamon sugar inside it. That sounds really good for French toast, dude.
Yeah, it's braided and it has like, I like the cinnamon a little bit better for French toast because it kind of aligns with our standard French toast. But as you said, it is a rich yeasted bread and it's just really, it kind of like takes that brioche concept to that next level. And I have to shout out Breads because it is a great product in New York City. You can order online.
I think that's the best babka I've ever had in my life.
All right. So your take on the French toast is really think about the bread you're using more than the egg and the milk mixture.
What do you think here? My father was a savory French toast guy. Yeah. He did not really? Like sweet breakfast. He never understood that. And fascinatingly, my nephew was born, right after on the kind of like right after he passed away. And as a young boy, we gave him some syrup on his French toast. And he was like, that's disgusting. Why would you put like syrup on my bread and eggs? And he took after his grandpa. Hmm. So there are people out there, the minority of folks that prefer a savory French toast, salt and ketchup on their eggs, right? So that kind of makes sense. So I think there's a whole world that opens up. But for me, whether it's the bread you're using and, you know, soft Texas toast French toast or brioche French toast, or it's the toppings, right? Like you can make a really decadent banana and Nutella, you know, French toast concoction that takes breakfast into dessert pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Matt, you're like a croque madame, croque monsieur guy. So there's obviously
no Monte Cristo. Actually, a sandwich with ham, mm-hmm. using the French toast parts for that next day, or even if you want to just make it dedicated to the Monte Cristo.
There you go.
A Monte Cristo, which I have never actually eaten, and like only remember from the last time I went to like an IHOP. That's like it's like two pieces of French toast with ham in the middle.
Ham and cheese and maple syrup, usually. You're actually...
Ham and cheese?
Ham and Swiss.
And maple syrup?
Swiss, usually, exactly. It's a Swiss. And it's definitely Midwestern diner material, and I love it. It's a good one.
All right, let's go to Maureen.
Hi, Francis and guests. This is Maureen in San Francisco, and I would like to find out more about breadcrumbs. I've seen recipes calling for panko. I have a blender and new food processor, and I would like to find out the best way to make them. Do I need to prep the bread? Best types of bread to use? I sometimes have a baguette around, and also how to store them. And if you could talk about why they're called for in recipes. Thank you.
I guess the first thing I'm going to say about panko is that it is a Japanese style of breadcrumb, and I don't think you can actually make, and it's usually it's called for in recipes because it fries up super, super light and crisp. So it's super crispy. It's not very crunchy, but it's very crispy and light. And I don't think you can make panko at home. I think it's like made sort of through this, like,
if you had a few $100,000 and the machine, yeah. you could probably get them, create the machinery. If you were an electromechanical engineer, no problem. I mean, classic Italian style breadcrumbs are, you know, were invented by, I started with stale bread. What do I do with it? I crush it up and I add it to stuff. So I think, yeah, absolutely. As a guy who's made it, you know, I had a restaurant in New York, and we had sandwiches, and we made meatballs. And every day, at the end of the day, we would take the old bread, and we would open it up and let it, you know, stale overnight. And then the next day, we would grind it up. We use a food processor and a strainer, and you'd make breadcrumbs. And I found them to be delicious. The only caveat to that is, you know, if there is any cinnamon in your bread, it is the most... It's that ingredient. You can put like a tiny sprinkle in the bread, and it'll flavor everything forever. You can taste it. So be aware.
It's like the nuclear waste of cooking. It'll like taint it just with like a very like a tiny gram. Yeah.
So other than you know, being aware if there are ingredients in the bread, it's a great thing to do. And you, and as far as what you use breadcrumbs for, I mean, they're just infinite. You know, whether you're making meatloaf and it becomes the binder with eggs to help cement the things together, or whether you're crusting something like chicken cutlets on the outside. I love using breadcrumbs as a thickener and binder in sauces. Like, you know, you put a spoonful in your salsa verde and it takes the oil and the vinegar, and it kind of helps to not emulsify but bring it together.
Oh, that's a great idea.
We have a sauce in the cookbook that's kind of Middle Eastern, where the bread is actually blend bread. You know, you can use bread or breadcrumbs and blend with lemon juice and pine nuts, and it becomes a very, very creamy kind of like if you want to make a vegan what's the mayonnaise with garlic?
Aioli,
like a vegan aioli. Yeah. And that works really well. So breadcrumbs are really magical.
Also, I have to add that, like, if you fry breadcrumbs and you have enough oil in there and they're actually fried, they are shelf stable and they stick around for a while, and you can actually use them for a time to come. I think we forget that when we're doing like fresh breadcrumbs and not dusting it and or adding enough oil, and they go, you know, pretty flat after a few days.
Yeah, that idea of fried breadcrumbs for me is like, they're the greatest.
Yeah. That sounds super awesome. All right. It has been a lot of fun talking to you. Thanks so much for coming through. Congratulations on the book.
It's been great.
Thank you, Francis.
Matt Rothbard and Daniel Holtzman are the authors of Food IQ, and you can find the recipe for frozen broiler steak at splendotable.org. Coming up, we're going to cook with Kenji Lopez-Alt out of his new book, The Wok. So hang on for some Japanese-style mapo tofu. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful, and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table@hero.co.
I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, so for food nerds, Kenji Lopez-Ault needs no introduction, but for the rest of y'all, he's a cooking columnist at the New York Times and is the culinary consultant for Serious Eats. He's one of the best voices in explaining the science behind cooking in a way that really makes you a better cook. He's a two-time New York Times bestselling author of the books The Food Lab and his new one called The Wok. It's everything you need to know about cooking with a wok at home, and for once, we're actually out in the world for this. Kenji had us in his lovely Seattle home with his dogs running around, like his baby sleeping upstairs, and instead of wanting to do something super complicated, he just wanted to show us how to make his family's favorite home food.
Hey, Kenji.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for having me in your house. This is awesome. This is where the magic gets made.
This is where the messes get made, yeah.
Messes are magic. You know, when you have children, that's what you have to tell yourself. So you just wrote a 672-page technique-driven book on the wok.
Yeah.
I come all the way across the entire country to come watch you cook in this wok, and you want to make something that's not really about the technique of the wok. So what are we even doing here?
We're making mapo tofu. So mapo tofu is a Sichuan dish, right?
Yeah.
Originally. And then it came to Japan in the 70s. And so there's a Japanese version of mapo tofu, which has a sort of different flavor profile. So instead of the sort of numbing hot mala profile, it has more of a sort of savory, hot and sweet flavor profile that's more favored by the Japanese. So my mom loves mapo tofu, the Japanese version. And so when she came to the U.S. and was living in New York, when we were growing up in New York, we lived in Morningside Heights, and I don't know when did you grow up in New York?
I grew up in New Jersey. Yeah.
In New Jersey, okay. And I don't know how familiar you were with what Morningside Heights was like in the 80s, but where that fairway is, which is now closed, there used to be a bunch of like butcher shops and sort of like meatpacking shops.
Yeah.
And so there were always
like
people
under the highway.
Yeah, exactly.
Under the shadow of the George Washington Bridge.
Yeah. Like old school, like butchers with like sawdust on the floors.
Yeah.
Who give you like slices of bologna when you walk in. But there was always a guy at the stoplight on 125th and Broadway. Or Riverside, who would come up to your car window while you were stopped there and try and sell you frozen meat out of a cooler, because I think he'd been like swiping it from the butcher shops. So my mom would buy steak.
How did I come all the way to Seattle and just feel this pang of like, God, I love New York?
My mom would buy steak from them and sometimes ground beef. But we had a lot of ground beef growing up because we lived not nearby there. So my mom would make like, you know, like
a ground beef fencer.
My mom, she would make a mix of Japanese food and also sort of, you know, sort of more American Betty Crocker type, New York Times Betty Crocker, you know, recipes that she found. And so she would make, use some of the beef to make like Italian American meat sauce, right?
Okay, sure.
And then the rest of the beef she would use to make dumpling filling. And so me and my sisters would, when we were little, once a month or so, would sit there and fold dumplings, you know, in front of the TV so to put in the freezer. Which is something I still do with my daughter now. But whatever leftover dumpling filling there was became the base for the mapo tofu.
Okay.
So the mapo tofu was a little bit different every time because the dumpling filling was like ground beef plus garlic, ginger, and whatever frozen vegetables she had usually. Uh-huh. And so sometimes there was like carrots in it. Sometimes there was like frozen spinach, whatever. But mapo tofu was my favorite dish growing up. So what I'm making today is my version of my mom's version
of the Japanese version of mapo tofu.
Yeah, exactly. Because I wrote in the book, this is my mom's version of mapo tofu. And then when I showed it, she's like, I never put sake in there for you kids. I was like, okay, well, I guess this is my version.
Memory is a fickle thing.
Yeah.
Memory and imagination are closely linked.
Yes. I don't know. Should I start cooking?
Yeah. Right?
Start okay. So today we're going to make it actually today. I was at the Japanese market yesterday and I found these ramps, which are an East Coast seasonal vegetable, but they had them here, so I love ramps, so I picked them up. So we're going to use these ramps instead of the scallions my mom would normally use.
Right on. So this is a Pacific Northwest version of Kenji's version of his mom's version of the Japanese version of a Sichuan dish.
Yeah, well, I mean, in every case, I think it has to do with making, you know, making it according to your own taste and your regional taste, and then also, you know, the way my mom did it based on what she had
around
her.
Yeah, like you said, with frozen spinach or frozen carrots one day or whatever.
We're using fresh ramps. Okay. Same thing, right?
So here's your walk, one of your six walks,
I believe. Well, I think I've given a bunch away, but right now there's three up here. But this is the one that I bought in, I bought this out of Target in Somerville in 1999 or 2000, when I was in college.
All right, so this is the walk that's in your heart.
Yeah. This one, so it's gone, it has some problems now. So the handle rotates.
So it spins a little.
So you got to be careful with that. And then it just started also leaking out of this rivet, so I can't make stock in this walk anymore because it dribbles down. But that just started like a few weeks ago, that
problem. 23 years for a walk from Target? Pretty good.
Yeah. All right. So a little bit of oil.
Okay.
Gonna go in with our...
So this is not a typical stir fry in the sense that it's not blazing hot.
Well, I wouldn't call blazing hot a typical stir fry. A lot of stir fries are blazing hot, but yeah. I think that's sort of a misconception that people have that you always need this like really blazing hot heat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this stir fry is a very relaxed one. I would say like of all the ones in the book, this one and perhaps the Thai pork with basil. I don't know if you're familiar with that pad krapao.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That dish. These two are like the simplest ones in the book because they don't require crazy high heat. They're more sort of about infusing the oil with some flavor from the aromatics,
mm-hmm.
and then everything's kind of gentle. You know, so this dish is really more of a braise,
sure,
than a stir fry. So you do stir fry some ingredients at the very beginning, but then we're going to add a bunch of liquid and let it sort of simmer for a bit.
Right on.
I always had this idea that stir fries require crazy high heat. And if you go online and look at like online forums, people will be like, oh, it's not worth buying a wok because you can't cook real Chinese food without crazy high heat.
Without like a jet engine for a stove.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think part of that conception comes because a lot of growing up in the West, at least a lot of people's experience with Chinese food is in restaurants.
Sure.
And in particular, Southern Chinese, Cantonese restaurants, right, where a lot of those dishes do have very high heat, but people cooking at home don't always do that, right? It's not like everybody cooking at home in China has a jet engine burner, right? And so I think there's this whole wealth of home cooking, which I mean, you're familiar with, that doesn't require ridiculous burners to do, right?
Sure.
So we got the garlic and ginger and scallions and beef going. That's the smell that always, you know, reminds me of my mom cooking this at home.
Yeah.
And then I'm doing a little bit of doubanjiang, so fermented chili bean paste.
Mm-hmm.
My mom didn't always do that. You know, it's sort of similar. Like with my daughter, sometimes she likes spicy food and sometimes she doesn't.
Yeah,
you know. And my new one, my 7-month-old, like he can't handle any spice at all. But
shocking.
Yeah. Well, my daughter.
You thought about disowning him yet?
At his age, my daughter was actually okay with spicy food, but he like even the tiniest amount, he like freaks out.
Yeah, I feel like I may have ruined my kid so far because now she's attuned to, like, we'll say to her, and I think this was a mistake, oh, this is a little bit spicy for you, like as a warning, but then I think she starts to internalize, oh, spicy means I'm not gonna like it. So now it's like even black pepper she gets upset with, and I think I screwed that up as a parent.
Yeah, so I think saying you're not gonna like this is
that's crossing the Rubicon.
It's better to like tell them what it is, but then let them decide if they're going to like it or not, I think.
I love it. Take it out. You don't have to like it. Yeah.
So we're doing like the classic Japanese sake, mirin, soy sauce.
Okay.
Combo here. So chicken stock. Okay, so I added the sake and the mirin and the soy sauce, which is mm-hmm. that sort of classic Japanese sweet and savory combination, and then some chicken stock, and then the tofu, which is a firm, silken tofu.
Yeah.
In Sichuan, you would find it with sometimes with silken tofu, but often with very, very soft block-style tofu. Okay. But I always use the silken tofu just because that's what my mom always had.
God, it smells so good.
And that is it. Taste, make sure it's seasoned. So my mom would make it like this, but she would also often make it with the packets. I don't know if you're familiar with the either house brand or cook dough.
Oh yeah.
Tofu packets. We always had those at home.
That's great.
So this plus rice and dumplings was like our favorite meal growing up.
Can you cook rice on a stovetop?
Sometimes I do it in a pressure cooker, but I, rice was kind of like my like white whale. You know, it was like really difficult for me to cook rice because I grew up with a rice cooker.
Yeah, you should have one. I'm like upset with you right now.
So I did have a rice cooker for a long time, and then in writing this book, actually, like I was like, I need to be able to cook rice in a pot because I need to be able to explain it. And so I practiced cooking rice in a pot, and now it just actually has become easier for me.
Oh, God. I'm so disappointed in you.
I did for a while do it in a pressure, you know, like a countertop pressure cooker. We called this, when we were growing up, we called this Mapo Gorp.
Mapo Gorp?
Yeah, because the texture is kind of gorpy. Yeah.
Okay, so the smell is like... You can definitely smell the doubanjiang, the chili bean paste, which is really like funky and aromatic. Mm-hmm. But it's much milder, like you said. It's not slaked in like
chili and it doesn't oil. Have that like big slick of chili oil, and it doesn't have the main aroma difference. I think is that it doesn't have the Sichuan peppercorns that like citrusy,
which is like super floral and citrusy. Yeah. Oh, but it's good.
This is. Yeah, comfort food for me.
Total comfort food. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. And it's like funny, like people who don't love tofu, I think will often see this dish and be like, why even add the tofu? Because it doesn't add flavor.
Yeah, but
I think that like misses the point, right? Because the tofu is like, the texture of the tofu, especially the silken tofu, mm-hmm. it's like, it creates a slipperiness in the mouth.
Right.
That's so nice mm-hmm. with like a really nicely cooked rice.
Mm-hmm.
Yum.
Yeah, this is an interesting dish to me to introduce people to tofu also because I think, you know, a lot of people think of tofu as a meat substitute and a dish like this which has meat and tofu, it's like, oh, why does it have both? Well, it's because they're not a substitute for each other. They bring different things to the dish.
Now, you've actually had this dish. Well, not this dish, but you've had Mapo Tofu at Chen Mapo Tofu, which is the restaurant in Chengdu, China, where... apocryphally was invented.
Yeah, well, I think the restaurant was started after the dish was invented I think they still serve. They were the first restaurant that used the recipe that she,
like the originator,
created exactly.
Describe that version of the dish for us.
It comes to your table in a little cast iron pot that's been preheated, so it's like bubbling at the table, and it's. You know what? It's what. So I learned how to make the Sichuan version from a chef, a Sichuan chef at a restaurant in Malden, outside of Boston. Mm-hmm. That restaurant's closed now, but I learned how to make it from him, and he learned it in Sichuan. And what he described was that the dish is hot in three ways. Mm. You know, so it's the ma and the la, the numbing hot and the spicy hot, right? But then also it's very important that it's temperature hot. And he said that the reason that there's that slick of oil over the top is that it like insulates the dish. Right. And so when you get it at Chen restaurant, it stays hot for like half an hour, you know, like you just let it sit there. It'll just keep bubbling and stay really, really hot the whole time. And then it has that classic mala flavor profile. So numbing from the Sichuan peppercorns and hot from the chili oil. And I think, you know, the reason for me that flavor profile works is that you eat it and it initially tastes really spicy, right? And and then your mouth starts to get a little bit numb from it, and then that numbing kind of makes it more tolerable to eat more hot stuff, you know? And like, so to me, like that's kind of like what's addicting about it, because you want to get that like it's like, oh, it's not that hot anymore. I want to get another hit of that. And so you take another bite, and then it's spicy again, and then it becomes numb again. So it's like, yeah, it's one of those dishes where it's like you just have to eat and eat.
Yeah,
and eat
until it's done. It's like a form of discipline, but it's also like it's so good.
Yeah,
I
can't stop.
So I love that, you know, I started this thing by saying, I came here to learn about, like, your awesome home wok technique where I don't need, like, a million BTU burner for. And you're like, let me show you this really gentle braise instead that my mom makes. But that idea that you have to have a crazy flame to make stir fries in a wok is really just based on restaurant cooking. And most home cooks don't have that.
Right.
There's also this idea, you know, that's sort of fetishized a little bit or mythologized, called wok hei, as we would say in Cantonese, and is often translated as the breath of the wok.
Right.
And I think you would, you know, and it can be ephemeral. It can be this idea that's sort of almost more cultural than culinary. Like people talk about it in this sort of like mystique way.
Right.
But I think you and I share a view on it, which is, oh, it's actually a particular flavor of slightly incinerated oil.
Right.
Which does happen when you have high heat licking the sides and, you know,
and coming into the
wok, right? And like just barely flaming some of the oil that's in the
or very highly flaming the oil. Yeah. That's the case may be, but yeah.
So if you are looking for that flavor,
right,
you have actually developed a technique where you can do that on a home stove. Tell me about that.
Yeah. In the book, I mean, I go over it in the book, and actually if you go to Serious Eats, Tim Chen also like simultaneously came up with the technique and published it. He calls it torch hay, which I think is a great term for it. Where, you know, basically instead of, this works on electric or induction, but instead of skillfully tossing the food through the flame of a gas burner, you just use a kitchen torch. So butane or propane torch, and you basically, with his technique, you point it into the wok while you're tossing. The way I do it is a little bit simpler. You stir fry your food in batches, and then you lay it out onto aluminum sheet trays. In sort of a single layer, and then as you cook, once you're done cooking in batches and all your food is laid out, then you take the torch and kind of gently brulee it, flame it all over, and then put it all back in the wok and toss it with the sauce, and it picks up that smoky flavor.
Right on. I love that. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm dying to.
Yeah. I mean, it works well. You know, there's only certain dishes that need that. Like a dish like mapo tofu doesn't have wok hei,
right?
But you think about dishes like beef chow fun, right? The essential flavor of that is that smokiness. But you can sort of get that flavor by using a torch.
Right on. All right. Well, this has been a blast. Thank you so much, Kenji.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Kenji Lopez-Alt is the author of The Wok. You can find his recipe for Japanese-style mapo tofu at our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that is our show for the week. We hope you loved our little field trip, because, boy, did we enjoy it. And if you ever have any cooking questions for us, record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them to contact@splendidtable.org. Talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.